Thank you. Thank you. I'm going to talk about blood pressure tonight, as you know. And one of the things about blood pressure that they've discovered is that if you are put under sudden pressure, like asked to give an impromptu speech in front of people, that, lo and behold, your blood pressure goes up. However, in front of a supportive female audience, that effect is lessened. And I was going to make a joke about all the men, please leave, but I realize I don't have to. You're all so, your feminine hearts are open tonight. I feel very welcome. Thank you. Thank you. So, I'm not going to just talk about Ayurveda, the science of life, today, but I wanted to just start with that, the wholeness. And I just returned from St. Petersburg, Florida, at the 12th Annual Science and Clinical Application of Integrative Holistic Medicine Conference. And this conference is one that supports the idea that we are more than the sum of our parts, and we are more than the sum of our body systems and organs. And it aims to address the patient, the person, as a person, as a whole being, spiritual, mental, physical being. And they're all extremely intelligent and very highly evolved doctors with very soft and caring hearts. And it's a beautiful conference to attend. I gave the talk on Ayurveda to introduce them to this system of medicine. And I wanted to share with you that the feeling I had there and the appreciation I gained, again, for the knowledge that we have, not only with Ayurveda, but with Maharshi Ayurveda. What is different about Maharshi Ayurveda is that wholeness value, the truly holistic quality of the approach to the person and the understanding of the person and their spirit and their mind and their body and how they're all connected. Nobody else has that true whole picture. And we have it. And not only do we have it, but we live it. We live it every day. And when we close our eyes, we can transcend and experience that wholeness within. And for many of us, that wholeness is growing, and that experience, even in our activity, is becoming more holistic. And a testament to that and to their desire to really understand more and more what integrative holistic medicine truly is, I wanted to share with you their favorite slides. Several of the doctors came up to me afterwards and told me how their favorite slides were, and they were always these two. This slide, sorry, it's a little out of focus, but it gives a picture of what these doshas are. They were always mystified by this sort of vague, abstract term when they would hear lectures on Ayurveda. What's this dosha and what's it all about? And this slide put the doshas of Vata, Pitta, Kapha in the context of the wholeness of the person and their life and all the influences impacting them, and then not only impacting them as a whole person, but then as their organs and tissues and cells and DNA and subatomic particles ultimately. But then I put in first the slide with just the unified field below and said how that, the physicists, of course, you know all this, tell us is the field of intelligence that gives rise to all the material and spiritual aspects of creation. And the next slide was the doshas. This is where the doshas operate, at that junction point of intelligence or consciousness, the Vedic system says, and the physical. And these doshas are like operators. They are intelligence that's guiding the expression of intelligence from this underlying field that we're all connected to, that we are all being created from, and the actual physical material body. And they really got that. And the next slide, of course, was their absolute favorite. They have a test at the end of the week, and I quipped that this was going to be on the test. But they didn't get too worried, but I described to them as best I could this slide by Dr. John Hagelin on the structure of the unified quantum field, which includes the origins of what we know to be Ayurveda with the five elements just above the Planck scale of the spin, five spin types, graviton, gravitino. I can't even begin to do it like he does. And then the three superfields, which form the three doshas. And then from there, all of the material aspects of physiology. So one of the underlying themes of tonight's talk is that modern medicine is truly returning. It's really just rediscovering its roots in Ayurveda. And everything that I'll talk about today, you know, it all boils down to something very, very simple. And it's what Ayurveda has been saying, you know, since time immemorial, is it's about balance. You know, balance within the mind, balance within our consciousness, balance within our routine, within our lifestyle, balance in our relationships. It's all about balance. And in fact, Maharshi, as it says on the Vata tea box, says that balance is the key to perfect health. So we know the three pillars of health. Ayurveda says diet, sleep, and consciousness. And we'd have to add two more pillars of health. You see there's a fourth one on this list, and there's even a fifth one that we're going to go into today. So we have exercise, which was built into the old lifestyle, and then we have, of course, today something else to contend with, the toxicity in the environment. So I wanted to tell you, some of you have heard me tell this story, but I was very impressed years ago when I was in Holland, and I had the opportunity to sit in on some consultations with a very great Vaidya there who was studying with Maharshi and working with him and developing some new aspects of pulse diagnosis and of the knowledge of Maharshi Ayurveda. And I had the opportunity to have several of my patients that I knew very well actually see him and sit in and hear what he had to say about their physiology. And one of my patients was about a 76-year-old gentleman who was quite worried about his health. And although he appeared to be very healthy, he had a little bit of blood pressure problem. But other than that, he was doing well. So the Vaidya took his pulse. And this Vaidya takes the pulse for about 1 hour, nonstop, and all the time talking about what he's feeling. And often it's a very detailed description of what he's seeing and experiencing of that person's mental state, their style of being, and how all of that is impacting their health. It was very, very fascinating. So the first thing that he said when he put his fingers on my patient's pulse, within a minute he said, he just stopped and he looked directly at the patient and he said, "Don't even think of living anything less than 120 years. I'm not sure my patient was convinced. But even more than that, I wasn't convinced. I was very, I was kind of inspired by it, but I kind of thought, well, this is one of those Ayurvedic slokas or ideas that were true maybe 5,000 years ago before much of recorded history, but today it's not very realistic. But when I went back to my home and I started to research aging and anti-aging, I discovered that there's a formula for predicting the natural lifespan of a species. And that formula is 6 times the number of years it takes for an individual of that species, in our case human beings, to mature. So we'd say maybe, depending on what you prefer, 18 or 21, we could pick perhaps 20. 6 times 20, anybody? Yeah, 120. So as I was reading more, of course, the oldest recorded, documented living human was a woman in France who lived to be 122. So it is certainly within the range of our human genome. And in fact, since that time, which was about 5 or 6 years ago, further research on aging and lifespan is opening the door even wider and saying we could potentially live much, much longer than 120 years. We don't have to age at this rate, and we don't even have to be limited by 120 years. In fact, when I mentioned that to Rogers Badgett, who, of course, helped establish the Raj, Ayurveda Health Spa, he said that the Vaidyas told him that 120 years was the lifespan in Kali Yuga, which means, you know, when there's a lot of disorder and imbalance in the world and toxicity, you know, what the age we're just leaving now. And that really people can live much, much longer than that. So that's being discovered. And there are certain things that they've discovered so far that can turn on genes that will allow much longer lifespan, certainly in animals. Now this human studies are starting to happen, such as the really fun idea of caloric restriction. Yeah, cutting 25% off the daily intake calories. Also, resveratrol, which is an expensive compound to take. But fortunately, I discovered that it is present in something that Maharshi Ayurveda has had at its disposal all along, and that is Amrit nectar. Amrit nectar contains resveratrol. And that was discovered long before resveratrol was such a hot topic. So those are two ways of enhancing lifespan according to initial studies. So more and more is going to come out, and I'm sure that as we get further into this new age, the age of Satyuga, that we'll discover more and more ways to extend lifespan much, much, much longer. But here we are, 2011. Most of us are over 50 or brought somebody who's over 50, since that's the title of the lecture, or perhaps they're just preparing well in advance. Good for you. So in this situation, of course, we have certain advantages. You know, we've been meditating. We are meditating every day. We know that practicing transcendental meditation can decrease the risk of premature death from heart disease by almost 50%. And that's just TM 20 minutes twice a day in new meditators. So that's a very inspiring thing. It does also present some specific challenges, I believe, to our community, and that's something I wanted to share with you tonight. In fact, I could say the eighth secret, I said this is seven secrets of health after 50, the eighth secret is that I really want to share with you some of the insights that I've gained and the observations I've made that I hope I can convey to you tonight and that will make a difference in your health. I think I'm looking at almost as expert in Ayurveda people as anybody on this planet. You all know these principles so well. But I'd like to address with you another aspect of health and medicine and our health care, and that is integrative. In fact, in Maharshi's last few years, he restructured his vision or presented a new vision to us. It may have been what he intended all along, but he presented a new vision of what he wanted Maharshi Vedic medicine to look like. And basically, he said, of course, Maharshi Ayurveda as the foundation, but also modern medicine. And his vision of health centers that he wishes and to establish, and there's a team now working on it, headed by Robert Keith Wallace and Robert Schneider. They're working on establishing Maharshi health centers, which will be like hospitals, which will include both Ayurveda and modern medicine And I'm very grateful for the concept of everything that works. You know, Maharishi opened the door wide open. Everything on the planet, and perhaps even off the planet, anything that works. He never said. So anything that is, you know, proven to work or has lasted so many hundreds or thousands of years that it has a very strong tradition and it's well accepted, that was another criteria for inclusion in his Maharishi health centers. And I felt that this was really such a compassionate gift to us all, to give us this vision and inspiration of doing what really hasn't been done before, to integrate all of modern medicine, all the latest diagnostic equipment, all of the treatments that can be necessary in some certain circumstances, along with Ayurveda, along with Maharishi Ayurveda, and along with whatever else can help a person. You know, what power lies in their potential, lies in this approach. So that is the vision that he left us with. And yet I realize that many of us have heard his message in general to the society and the world for so many years. Modern medicine is poison. Side effects of modern medicine. You know, we've heard so many times, because that's what the world needs to hear. It has needed to hear that. It has needed to become aware of the risks of this deeply entrenched model that everyone's taken for granted, and many people just automatically feel it's the solution or the best solution available. But thanks to Maharishi knocking on that really strong barrier, it started to crumble, and now we understand the drug companies are starting to lose their hold on doctors. Doctors at this conference were commenting on how, you know, they can't go to conference anymore and get freebies, right, from the drug companies. They just don't exist anymore. No pens and no tablets or trips to the Caribbean. Thank goodness. You know, it's extremely carefully regulated. So the new doctors, the new generation of doctors will not be brainwashed into accepting data that really isn't true. On the other hand, Maharishi felt, and this was communicated to me also by people who worked very closely with him on this project and related projects, that he was not happy with people basically having missed diagnoses. He was not happy with that. He was really wanted people to have the best of both. And I feel that that's something that we all should really take to heart. Particularly, Maharishi also had a desire for modern medical diagnosis from a very for many years, when a vaidya from India came to our clinic in Washington, D.C., he said that he had been set on a project to research all of the diagnostic centers in India and look at what were the latest technology, and with the eye of setting up such a center at some point. So the diagnostic approach of modern medicine, and also when needed to save a life, when needed to really do the job, modern medicine. In fact, one person who had a serious illness, was a type of blood cancer, was in the hospital and debating whether he should do the treatment that was being recommended. And the message that came to him was, modern medicine to destroy the Rakshasa and Ayurveda to restore the Devata. So he did the treatment, and he beat odds, and he's still here with us 20-some years later to tell the story, and indeed inspires many other people with his success with both of those together. So I'd like to share with you now some practical wisdom, practical information, and some stories, and then take some questions. I'd like to make sure we have time for questions at the end, because I know there are various issues that you have on your mind. So when I mentioned that we're coming full circle to Ayurveda, remember these three pillars of health as we go through the following information, because basically it's diet, it's sleep, it's consciousness, stress, and it's exercise, and we'll also find it's detoxification. So I won't ask how many people here have high blood pressure, but maybe you can ask yourself if you have high blood pressure. And as you ask yourself that, if you think maybe you do, then it's probably an issue for you. And I've worked with a lot of people that, you know, the tendency is to kind of go, well, you know, it was up at the doctor's office that time, but, you know, I took it another time and it was kind of okay. It was maybe 130 over 80, and that 148 or 155 over 90 was kind of an aberration. And you can kind of go back and forth. You don't go to the doctor very often or take your blood pressure very often. You know, there's kind of a tendency to slip into thinking it's kind of all right, because blood pressure doesn't usually cause symptoms. That's why they call it, pardon me for this, in this delicate audience of highly refined consciousness, but they do call it the silent killer. So I just want to encourage everyone to take their blood pressure seriously. And by that can be as serious as taking an exercise regimen seriously. I mean, really seriously. I've worked with somebody, a lady, who is just turning 60, and I measured some high blood pressures with her, and they kind of ranged from 140 to 150, 160 when she was in pain. So it was kind of flirting around the kind of mild to moderately elevated blood pressure. And, you know, I told her, you really need to exercise because you can reverse this now, but, you know, every day that this goes on, you're wearing down the inside of your arteries, and that, you know, causes plaque to form and causes, you know, ultimately, you know, clogging of the srotas. We know what that is. It's not good. And so she didn't really take it seriously at first, but finally when I sent her to her cardiologist, she decided to go. And she committed to exercise, really exercise, and really cut down on some of the excess calories. And indeed, within about a month or 2 months, her blood pressure came down to really normal. And she felt so much more energetic. And also, she wasn't so worried anymore. Because in the back of the mind, when this is kind of rolling around, it creates its own stress. So what I would encourage you to do is, if you have high blood pressure or a tendency to high blood pressure, or you think maybe sometimes it's high, often that's what's called pre-hypertension, and it will progress as you get older unless you change what you're doing. So let's go over some of the things that you can do. I mentioned five approaches to lowering your blood pressure naturally. So here we have, of course, diet. Wholesome diet, whole grains, fresh fruits, vegetables, nuts, seeds, low-fat dairy, is the DASH diet, diet against systolic hypertension. And indeed, this works well for a lot of people. It's actually kind of like the Mediterranean diet. It's basically like our diet with maybe a little less rice and a little less, certainly less any sweets. There are no sweets here except the whole fruit. It's also a low-sodium diet, and that works well for a certain percentage of people. Now, if you try a low-sodium diet and your blood pressure doesn't go down, you just may not be salt-sensitive. It may not be an issue for you. And in fact, in some men, it's been found if they restrict salt too much, their blood pressure actually goes up. So you have to monitor what happens if you follow this. But I have one patient, again, who shocked himself, actually, when he decided he was really going to change his diet for his blood pressure. He started cooking at home. Didn't go to restaurants, didn't go to cafeterias. He just cooked at home. And within about 2 weeks, his blood pressure was down by 20 points, and it was basically normal. So salt can make a big difference. Okay, so people know about diet. Now let's talk about exercise. Exercise is medicine. There was a very interesting study that came out of the American College of Sports Medicine last year. And it found that actually 35% of coronary heart disease in the U.S. can be attributed to an inactive lifestyle. And it also found that people who are sedentary have extra risk of of cardiovascular disease, even if they exercise regularly. So that's another issue. Anybody here sit for a lot of the hours of the day? Well, if you do the recommended half hour a day aerobic exercise, and then you will help, you know, to lower your risk, you'll mitigate it, but you won't lower it as much as somebody who's like a nurse who's walking up and down a hospital wards all day long and then maybe goes to the gym, you know, or does an exercise class 3 or 4 days a week. So consistent exercise, of course, can reduce risk, and exercise combined with a healthy diet and weight loss also reduces diabetes. Okay, so benefits of exercise. I won't go through all of these individually, but basically it improves everything that helps your arteries and also, of course, prevents diabetes. I wanted to mention to people that when I first started practice, I was in Washington, D.C. at the Maharishi Ayurveda Medical Center of Washington, D.C. area. And most of my patients in the beginning were meditators, and they were in their 30s generally. And basically they had what we would call functional symptoms, like maybe they didn't sleep so well, or maybe they had some digestive issue, or they had some skin problem, or something that was usually kind of what we would say in Ayurvedic, one of the stage one or stage two levels of imbalance, the doshas getting aggravated, but nothing really specific, nothing serious. And then as people got into their 40s and then their 50s, risk factors started to pop up more and more. Blood pressures in some people started to go up. Cholesterol started to go up. Some of these things that start seeing the first stages of some disease starting. And then, of course, unfortunately, I mean, very, very sadly, as people are reaching their 60s, even in our group of our community of people who are meditating and doing all these healthy things, you know, some of the more serious things are starting to happen, like heart attacks and strokes, and it's a serious thing. And that's really why I'm encouraging everybody to really take your blood pressure seriously, take your exercise seriously, if there is exercise, or really seriously start to do some exercise. Maybe make a commitment with a buddy. Research has shown that having an exercise buddy increases the, we could say, the commitment and the regularity of exercise. Or get a personal trainer, at least for perhaps maybe 5 to 10 sessions, so you get in the habit of going and get into a routine and you kind of know what you're doing, if you're going to do weightlifting as well as do some aerobic. So this is the time. Ayurveda says 45 to 55 is the most important decade. It creates the foundation of our later health. So if you're beyond that, we can employ the meditator safety factor rule, which is you get another 10 years at least. So if you're 55 to 65, we're going to give you an opportunity. Even if you're over that, it's incremental, you know. It's incremental. So it's never too late to start. In fact, it's been found that men in their 50s who were completely out of shape and were put on a very specific, you know, targeted and quite rigorous exercise program, about an hour and a half every day under supervision, that they were able to return to a level of fitness they had in their 20s. Seriously. within about 6 months. It's amazing. And in fact, I was just working with someone that within about very out of shape and very at risk, within about 3 sessions of going to the gym, said that they already felt better, more energy, more lightness, like the body didn't feel so heavy anymore. It's amazing. That was just 20 minutes on a elliptical, like 3 times. Okay, here are some of the goodies of physical activity: better memory, protects your brain and hippocampus, better mood, energy, of course, a glowing complexion. It also stimulates growth hormone. All of those of you who like to take growth hormone precursors, go to the gym and start pumping iron, and you'll also create growth hormone in just the right amount that your body wants and needs without any risk of side effects. Builds bone density, and of course makes you feel really good about yourself. Physical activity. So let's go into how much. The latest recommendation is pretty doable. It's only about 20 minutes a day of aerobic activity. And some weights or some kind of strength training 2 to 3 times a week. And interestingly, if you're trying to lower your blood pressure, if you walk 20 minutes twice a day, it has greater effect than 40 minutes once a day. So if you're in the habit of going, maybe walking from where you are to go to program in the morning and back, and then evening, that's really good. And 10 minutes steady is kind of the minimum to get the ideal effect of the exercise, but even with less than that, it's cumulative over the day. In fact, some people who are forced to eat 1,000 calories more as part of an experiment, some people really gained a lot of weight, 1,000 calories more a day. And some people didn't. And then they went back and looked, and they discovered that those people managed to fidget their 1,000 calories off every day. They must have been Vata types. So, okay. All right, one last thing about exercise and thinness and fitness. You know, many people are quite thin. Maybe they follow a really careful diet. They're very thin, but maybe they don't do much more than maybe walk to their car and back. Well, it turns out that being thin and out of shape is still a risk factor, at least in people who've already had heart attacks. Found out that those people are midway between a person who's at high risk because they're obese, like the abdominal obesity, in other words, the big tummy, that's the biggest risk factor. You know, if you have weight that's mainly in the abdomen, of course, that's what promotes, that kind of fat there promotes diabetes, promotes inflammation, promotes heart disease. So those people who were abdominally obese and out of shape, of course, had the worst prognosis. They had about a 10 times risk of dying early. Those who were abdominally obese and fit only had a 2 times, twice the risk of dying early. That's huge. So if you're overweight, just getting fit without even losing weight is a big, big, big improvement in your lifespan or your risk, or your potential to live a long life. But the thin, out-of-shape people were in between the two. So they weren't as good as the really overweight fit person. But they weren't as bad as the overweight not fit person. So for those of you who are thin but really have never or haven't lately been exercising and are getting out of shape, now's a good time, better than any other, to get started with your exercise. Okay, so some last points on, I'm going to go quickly now through a few more things for diet that lower blood pressure. And this is in studies. It may not work for you, but you can try it. Soy milk, 2 cups per day, lowered systolic 18 points. Amazing. Soy milk, 2 cups per day, lowered blood pressure, systolic 18 points. Liberal use of fresh garlic, if your friends can stand it. Maybe if everybody does that, we'll be immune to blood pressure and we won't smell it anymore. Okay, so supplements, lots of people around here taking L-arginine. There is some research that shows 2 grams a day improves blood pressure. Taurine. Taurine is an interesting substance. It's a non-essential amino acid, but a very important one for immunity and for a number of other factors in the body. And taurine tends to be low in vegetarians. I've tested amino acid profiles in dozens and dozens, probably hundreds of people by now, most of them living in this community. And I will have to say that taurine is probably the most common thing to be low. Taurine is found in poultry. It also can be taken as a supplement. And when it's low, it's found to be low in people with high blood pressure often. Studies show that taking up to 6 grams a day, which is quite a large amount, can lower blood pressure substantially. But the recommendation is not to take that much, but maybe 1 to 2 grams a day. CoQ10, 60 milligrams twice a day by 3 studies, showed it reduced systolic blood pressure by 16 to 18%, 16 to 18 points, millimeters of mercury. That's pretty substantial also. Again, no guarantee it will work. And importantly, I just encourage you to avoid the trap of doing a lot of things for your blood pressure so you feel like, okay, I'm doing all this stuff, but you kind of forget to take it. Like, you don't really verify it. So be sure, be real. Be real with yourself, because the effects going on in your body are happening, whether you kind of try to shove it under the rug or you face it. So be real. Take it. Check if these things are working and just drop them if they're not and try something else. Okay. The last thing is people should know, as we've had a brush with heavy metal toxicity in this community, people taking herbs from India that weren't direct from India, not tested in this country, not made sure they were pure, lead is a risk factor for high blood pressure. And the higher one's lead level, for example, a study in women after menopause, the higher the lead level, the higher the blood pressure. So heavy metals tend to accumulate in the kidneys, and they can really affect blood pressure. So steer clear of those. And there are ways to test for it, and there's ways to eliminate it naturally. Okay, now the last thing is when to take medication. One, there is mixed evidence for mild to moderate high blood pressure, whether taking medication really lowers mortality. Now, that doesn't mean that, lowering it through exercise and diet isn't a benefit. It is a benefit, but lowering it through drugs at a lower level may not be so beneficial. But when it gets up to about 160 over 100 or more, then it's definitely beneficial to treat it with medication and not to wait. So if somebody comes in and sees me and it's 160 over 100, then I highly recommend they start a medication until it comes down naturally. It's not like you have to take a medication forever. That's an old model of, the body's just getting more out of balance. And it's never going to go in the reverse direction. Now we know, even in modern medicine, starting to understand that the body can actually heal itself, can actually improve. So I want to encourage people. I can tell you lots of stories, and I'm not going to, take the time to do that. But, I've been in practice, unfortunately, long enough to see, people who, didn't make that choice and either are not here today or are, unable to, live in their lives as they had wanted to. I always think of one gentleman in his 40s in Washington, D.C., who was a very successful architect, owned his own firm, and I begged him, literally, every time he came and pressured him, because his blood pressure was 160, 170. He's only in his 40s, under immense pressure and tension, to meditate and to take medication, and he He didn't either, and came back to me about a year or two or three later, basically a hemorrhagic stroke. And he's not able to live his life as he did before. So it was very tough lesson, you know, for him, and also just, you know, reality. This can be, you know, very harsh. So on the other hand, we have tremendous resilience in the body and tremendous ability for the body to reverse disease process even within a few weeks. So I just encourage everybody to activate your healing response. Another thing quickly I wanted to share with you is the negative effects of excess blood sugar. It's turning out that this is part of the whole reduction in lifespan that we're seeing, and it's particularly in developed countries, and all the heart disease. Number one killer in America for men and women is what? It's cardiovascular disease, men and women. And it turns out that sugar increases salt retention, for one thing. It also increases inflammation. And we know that inflammation is key in cardiovascular disease. It's also key in dementia, in Alzheimer's disease. And there was a brilliant presentation by one doctor to us about holistic neurology, and he presented very fascinating information about the new connections being found between sugar and dementia and Alzheimer's. And basically, you don't want to have it. In fact, he was so convinced to stay away from sugar that he presented to us research on the ketogenic diet. And I don't mean just the, you know, Atkins, not just eating lots of red meat and such, but there are ways to have a pretty healthy diet and yet have a certain percentage of your food go to ketones, which are from fat. And the brain can burn this fat as well as glucose. And he made quite a convincing case for eating a diet much, much lower in carbohydrates than we normally do, and that's more natural to us. After all, you know, you think about it, the caveman, you know, how could he eat every 3 hours? What was there to eat? You know, the hunter-gatherers, you know, maybe they could put a few berries in the summer, but the human body evolved with long, you know, relatively long periods and many hours in between eating, sometimes days. And that actually makes you leaner. And I guess that's obvious. Also smarter. Keeps your Schrodinger's open. I have to tell you what happens when we have a sudden rise in our blood sugar. See, we didn't have, like, fresh orange juice, you know, back then. It was an orange, right? You didn't have juicers. We didn't have, you know, brownies, sugar cane. You know, none of that was there. Our bodies are not designed to handle a sudden input of sugar. We eat a bunch of sugar. The blood sugar goes zoop, and then insulin, right, comes after it, chases after it, but not before that sugar has already gone through the whole system. And what happens when the sugar penetrates our tissues? You know what happens when you spill something sugary on the floor, like some soda or some orange juice? Say you don't wipe it up right away and it dries. What's it like? Sticky. Remember what ama is like? It's sticky. Well, what happens is the tissues are made of molecules, and most of those molecules, or many of them, are proteins, right? Proteins are structural elements, and also enzymes, which run our metabolism. Well, the sugar sticks to the proteins, and then the proteins stick to each other. So you've got a gummy mess in the tissue. And that's what promotes things like kidney disease and diabetes and cataracts. And now we're learning dementia, stiffness. You know, sugar, unfortunately, is not very healthy, to say the least. particularly if you eat it on an empty stomach or you take it in a way that causes a sudden rise in your blood glucose. Just don't do it. And never have sugar before noon. I always knew that. Anyone here know that? You know, it's not the time to have a donut in the morning. Feel off all day. Well, I finally got validation for that experience because somebody presented research that showed that if you eat sugary breakfast, your insulin goes up and it stays up all day and it throws off your whole sugar handling system in your body for the day. We know that's coffee time, right? You're going to get your coffee aggravated. Well, that's what happens. Get your coffee aggravated. Sugar handling. So be very cautious in how you deal with your carbohydrates. You can save yourself getting diabetes later in life. That constant stress of sugar going in and insulin having to respond, that creates this insulin resistance. Your body no longer responds to insulin, and your liver starts producing sugar because it thinks that you don't have enough because it's not responding to insulin anymore, which would bring the sugar into the cells. So really, eat more whole. A lot of you people do, but I would say, you know, stick to date if you're going to have something sweet and have it after the meal so it absorbs slowly with plenty of fiber in the stomach. Okay, so now we're going to turn to another of my favorite topics, and that is our hormone health. Oops, pure sesame oil. I got to add that. Sesame oil, it turns out, can lower blood pressure. It's an amazing study of people who were already on blood pressure medication, and it was discovered that when they were given a sesame oil bottle or two and said, only eat your home-cooked food and only cook with this oil. And these people had blood pressure that wasn't normal even with two drugs. And they did that for 2 months. And they came back and their blood pressure had dropped dramatically, like 20-some points. It was really, really remarkable. Basically, most of them were in the normal range by then. Now, I've recommended this to a lot of people, but I think it's a very hard thing because, you know, people are eating out or people aren't cooking their own food. So I think this was actually done in India. So maybe they had a wife at home who was cooking all the food all day. But it points out the value of polyunsaturated fats if they're not rancid. They have to be fresh and not overheated. It also improved their triglycerides, their antioxidants, and reduced oxidation of the fat, which is something that occurs in cardiovascular disease. Healthy fats, you all know these things. Omega-3s, avoid refined oils, avoid overheating them. Flaxseed, walnuts, greens, all are rich in omega-3.